Today on Against the Grain, if we look back over the 20th century and even into the 19th, we can see a series of historical periods that shaped how food was produced and consumed. And as my guest today argues, we can see how periods of relative stability alternated with periods of crisis. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with sociologist Harriet Friedman about her theory of food regimes and what they tell us about how capitalism absorbs movements from below. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Agricultural production and consumption play key roles in shaping the global capitalist economy for political and social reasons that we often don't consider. The price of food, for example, not only matters to individual consumers, it also affects the wages that companies can choose to pay their workers. If the price of food is low, the cost of sustaining a worker is decreased, and hence wages can be held down. The theory of food regimes, which considers these central questions over the long span of history, illuminate a great deal about global capitalism and how it's shaped by bottom-up struggles and social movements. Harriet Friedman is the co-originator of the theory of food regimes. She's professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Toronto. Harriet, I wanted to begin by asking you about the food regime that came into being in the late 19th century and lasted to the beginning approximately of World War I. What was it and what caused it to emerge?
Well, the name I use for it in one article is settler colonial food regime. What were the main elements? And I use that in order to focus particularly on the people at the bottom, the agents in this thing, even though their choices are completely constrained by the power field, by states, by capital in that period. So one of the marking points is in the 1840s when the English abolished the corn laws, that is the import controls over grain. Before that, there was a demographic crisis, came from enclosures, from many things. So the Irish potato famine, many things happened, and that were also happening on the continent of Europe, that produced a desire of many people, or a necessity of many people, to move. And it was a vast migration of people that was facilitated by a complementary migration of capital to mainly build railroads. That was the main way that capital was expanding, and one of the main ways it was accumulating in that period. And a lot of it came from England, which is why the UK, the Great Britain, was the center of that food regime. The capital was coming from there. The people were coming partly from there, partly from other places, but facilitated by that. The places they were going, some of them are familiar, but some of them are forgotten. So the places they were going were places that were cleared of indigenous people militarily by expanding states. And the ones we're familiar with, of course, were the United States and Canada, which were doing it competitively in order to decide where the boundary between the two countries was. It was British North America at the beginning of this period. Argentina, Australia, New Zealand. But the ones we've forgotten about, the settler colonial expansions, Siberia, the Danube Basin, where the Tatars had kept the Russian, Ottoman, and Austrian empires from settling. My ancestors were brought from Germany, where Jews, Mennonites, others couldn't own land, invited by the Austro-Hungarian Empire to be settlers, right? And they looked a little different from the settlers here, but not all that different in a certain way. And the Japanese were doing it very early in the 19th century. So it was a time of state expansions territorially, and the violent expulsion of indigenous people and their movement, killing movement, all of it, and the invitation of settlers and a complete transformation of the landscape.
And tell us about the role of the working classes of Europe in this. This obviously took place in a period of great social unrest.
Right.
What role did that unrest play in the making of this food regime? And what sort of implications did it have for those workers as it became established?
Some of the threads there that are really important is that since the French Revolution, there was a fear of revolution in England, and it was often named Jacobins, the people who were scary to the ruling classes. And so this was a brilliant solution, send them off. The Irish potato famine, which, I mean, Ireland was one of the first cases of settler colonialism. It was a prefiguring of this period, and it produced some results where the Irish were dependent on the potatoes, as you know, even when the wheat was being exported. Well, those were a huge source of either unrest, because many of them were the people that Engels was writing about in the conditions of the working class in England in the 1840s. So by the 1870s, between the 1840s and the going on, this huge waves of people, displaced people who, on the one hand, were cheap labor, but on the other hand, were surplus, both to the needs of capital and to the emotional security of the ruling people. And then because of the shipping in particular, it became more economical for large numbers of people to go. And there had been the slave trade that was actually had been ended just a few decades before. There was still an illegal one going on. But so the shipment of people was something that had already been invented. And this is typical of regimes. Like, they can take elements of an earlier system and then reconfigure them in a new system. So now all these European migrants could come. Nobody needed passports. A lot of people didn't have last names, you know. So there was just a need by, or an encouragement by both capital for its own interests, the railways in particular. Oh, and there's one piece of this that's really important, which is the formation of these settler states, like Canada and Australia are particularly interesting because they were, the U.S. had become the first revolution, right, to create its own state, and it was both a rival and a complement to England. But Canada and Australia and New Zealand, they gained autonomy in a certain way in order to be able to sponsor the bonds for the railways, in order to be able to raise money in these emerging capital markets, which were fairly new at the time, or they had taken a new form and a new scale. So they were the ones who wanted to do the territorial expansion, and especially in North America, the competition between Canada and the U.S. for where the border would be, where to build the railways.
So what was the implication of the establishment of this food regime from 1870 to 1914, approximately, in terms of capital accumulation beyond agriculture? What were its larger implications?
I would say that, you know, I'm getting more and more convinced that the power field is that includes states and state activities has been more important to the history of capitalism, and certainly in this period. So the shift from the sugar as the dominant and slave trade as the dominant places of accumulation to heavy industries, especially steam and fossils. So steam shipping, although it wasn't important for wheat until the turn of the 20th century, because they made sailing ships bigger and it was a bulk commodity. So it wasn't the agriculture, in fact, that was the source of accumulation. The agriculture was a way that railways could be expanded. And that was a source of accumulation, and steam shipping and many of the things that went with it. So the other commerce, even tourism began for the rich, you know, with steamships and mail and telegraph and all of those things. It was almost incidental, but crucial to the accumulation of capital that these settlers be there and that these states expand their territory into areas that were self-organized ecosystems with indigenous people managing them.
Did the import of this wheat from the colonies or former colonies to Europe affect the wages of the workers in Europe?
For sure, yeah. So, yeah, it gave a stable food supply. It allowed, and between the two of them, the food coming in and the migration, out-migration of people, it meant that the possibility for people to organize unions and stabilize the working class in ways that, you know, labor historians have written about, and starting with Marx, really. All of that was really important. And it also created, and this is my favorite part of regime analysis, of how the elements, the contradictions emerge. So the elements of the new regime are hidden, you know, in the functioning of the existing regime. So the elements of what was to come later. So the United States, as a new hegemon, was being created territorially, the state system, the infrastructure, new forms of capital. So Chicago, William Cronin has written about this so brilliantly, Chicago was created as a new kind of city. It was a city that once again had its, had, let's say, wheat, animals, you know, the in its hinterland, but now it's not for Chicago itself. It's a flow-through system. So it has to shift everything onto railways, create stockyards, create wheat terminals, that physical infrastructure, and also the Chicago Exchange. So a new form of capital, commodity futures, new elaborations, new, as we'd say now, financial instruments, were created in the heart of the British food regime that were going to become much more central to the next regime. But you don't see that. They were actually serving the export of wheat and cattle.
Harriet Friedman is my guest. We're discussing food regimes and the history of food regimes, and she is one of the originators of the theory of food regimes. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So food regimes, they rise, but they also fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be replaced for a while by a new food regime. How did the one that we're just talking about come apart in the early 20th century?
Well, I'm going to take the origin a little further back. I already did with one of those elements, but I've just read a wonderful manuscript by a French writer, Benoît Daviron, economist, political ecologist. In particular, he talks about the scramble for Africa and other aspects of the expansion of imperialism, overseas imperialism in the 1890s, as a strategy of the losers. So it was mainly France, Germany, and Japan who developed further this old form of overseas territorial expansion in that period. But what was happening in the dominant world, and what when we tell the history that can be teleological, I'm trying to have it not be by adding these other pieces, is that it became a conflict between Britain as the center of a gold standard, organized, huge territorial expansion that encompassed the world. It was a shift from that to a national state-centered regime where the U.S. in particular became the model for what we often mean by development now. And third world countries or the countries of the South, everybody, developing societies, all this crazy language that we use has an idea an autonomous, internally integrated balance between sectors of agriculture, raw materials, food on one side, and industry on the other. And that was a new model that was at that moment, which the U.S. became the prototype for. And when it came to be the next hegemon, it created that model and the term development. I think that's disputed, but it's often attributed to Harry Truman at the end of World War II and naturalizing the idea that the British had used before, like improvement, that we're going to go help them. Well, now there's just something natural, like every country is an acorn that's going to turn into an oak tree unless there are obstacles or something. So that idea. Now, a lot of the politics of that came out of the new class configuration that had been created under the British regime. I'll call it that for short. And that is that farmers and these simple commodity producers, these export or commercial dependent, mainly household producers, family farmers, were the new class that had been created only a few decades before. They were different from the peasants of Europe, but they shared some characteristics with them. They were different from the workers in the industries that they were selling their food to, and yet they shared some characteristics with them, particularly being connected into the money economy. But they also were very well organized, and they were very, very progressive. It was a progressive party. They became very radical around monetary politics, silver, and many things in that period in the 1890s, and then World War I interrupted, let's just use that for this horrible thing that happened, right? All of that. And then it solidified the reality of crisis, crisis in the gold standard, crisis in trade, crisis in every element that had been central to the old regime. And when they tried to put it back in place, it didn't work. And so we got first a crisis in agricultural prices, then we got the Great Depression, the financial collapse, all of that happening in the 1920s. The New Deal coalition that grew up out of that, one of its three pillars was the farm lobby. And so we still use that language, even though the number of farmers is so greatly diminished and so many of the institutions that they created have been captured by agribusiness, which didn't yet exist. Or we could name some things that, but not as we know it now. So it was farmers who were very central to the politics, including the particular form of agricultural regulation of the New Deal, which was very unusual and is still a real problem for us, even though pieces of it have been changed. Problem for everybody now. And that is, instead of, what the British had already been doing with their farmers was, if they wanted to keep them going and they weren't making enough money by selling their crop, they would just give them the money at the end of it. It's called efficiency payments. And we have them now too, but the main feature of the U.S. New Deal farm regulation was to pay farmers not an income, even though it was set, there was a series of formulas in Congress that went through a wage that was parity with the income, the parity with the industrial wage. But what would they had to do, they thought, was to buy the commodities to keep the prices up, not to supplement the income. And that meant that they had to buy or offer to buy. It was done in the form of, there was a lot of complicated language. There was a lot of smoke and mirrors, so loans and so on. But basically, they were buying the commodities, and that raised the price relative to any world price that had now been created in the old regime. But now it no longer functioned because the U.S. government, if it's willing to buy at a subsidized price, then everyone in the world is going to send their wheat to the U.S. government. So it meant you had to have import controls, which they did. And that they're still with us. So one of the features of trying to take it apart so many years later was to try to have an agreement on agriculture, which in the World Trade Organization, which still isn't settled. So what they did originally was they excluded it from the General Agreement on the Tariffs and Trade and included anything to do with agriculture. It's why our farm laborers are paid less than they aren't covered by minimum wage or any of those regulatory things. And that's true all over the world. So the farmers were key, and they had an idea that it wasn't just the farmer's idea. There was an idea that it was more dignified to be paid a price for your commodity, even if it's subsidized, than it is to be getting something like a wage or a income payment. So that became a pillar, and it became replicated in very different ways in different parts of the new system, of the new regime. But I would say the interests of the farmers in the hegemonic, rising hegemonic power were the ones that were key to the particularities of this way of doing things.
And this food regime, which really coalesced immediately following World War II, mm-hmm. You call the mercantile industrial food regime.
Right.
And although it was international, it really, as you're saying, the U.S. farmers and the United States were central in the formation of this regime. What were the implications of this food regime for the relationship, including the geopolitical relationship, between the United States and what was then called the Third World? And how did that manifest itself in terms of what at the time was called food aid?
It's not just even though it's nation-centered, the rules made it nation-centered, in particular the monetary rules. So I think there's nothing like everything is integrated now, and we get these practices and discourses that arise that fool us in a way. So the idea that the nation state is central is an idea that comes out of this regime, not just the food regime, but the entire period of development, we could call it the development period. And it is an international set of rules that privilege the domestic economy. And that was done through the Bretton Woods monetary system, right? So the fixed currencies, replacing the gold standard, you had a system of fixed currencies, and those encouraged what we now call, or did begin to call, third world countries to overvalue their currency in order to privilege internal exchanges. And governments, it was a Keynesian kind of idea that could be implemented in various ways, and you also regulated trade. You had marketing boards, even for third world crops like cocoa in Ghana, or that sort of thing. Now, what in geopolitical terms, it was the time of the beginning of the taking apart mainly by the colonies themselves of the old European empires. And the U.S. was very interested in supporting this, but supporting it in a particular way, especially after the Cold War began. So that's why it's the Third World. The First World was the U.S.-centered NATO. It got different names, still does. Centered world, the capitalist world economy, that was pretty well segregated, not perfectly at all, but pretty well segregated from the socialist bloc, and they called it the Socialist International Division of Labor. That became very important for things like the Cuban Revolution, you know all of that. It was playing out. So these were not separate worlds. They were influencing each other partly by their relative separation. And the Third World was a language that developed in support of the non-aligned movement in the UN. So as some of the leading national liberation figures, Nasser in Egypt, the leader in Indonesia. There were a few, these really amazing figures who got together in the early, Nehru, in the early days of the United Nations and said, we don't want to be one or the other. We want to be non-aligned. And so this third world language developed. It was very important to hold on to a memory that that was a historical moment. And it was a language that referred to that moment. So when North-South came, it was a reconfiguration and a part of the crisis of this regime. But at the beginning of this regime, the third world, first it was included in U.S. Marshall Aid. It was very important because the colonies were part of the imperial balance of payments for England, for France, for the Netherlands, and they just counted Indian crops or, you know, Senegalese crops as their exports, you know, and all of the, it's really important to notice always how many of our accounting systems or conventions that then colonize our minds, you know. So that's what that was. And so the U.S. was able to give its Marshall Aid partly through the colonies. And that they were also able to use very few countries had any industry. Like Sweden had some, you know, but mostly it was the U.S. and the other countries in Europe. Everywhere else, they didn't have any foreign exchange. So under the Bretton Woods system, to be able to give this new institution called aid, always you give things a really nice term, you know. So, yeah. And you know, and it was. But it was also guided by a belief that we can see was an interest in creating a new kind of system. So, well, first it was anti-communism. That was part of it. But I won't go into that unless you want me to. But mainly from the point of view of creating a new agri-food system. It was about industrialization of agriculture. So that had begun in the U.S. Even before that, it had begun in Europe in certain ways, but everything has multiple origins if you want to trace it back. But in terms of the constellation that we now look at, the separation of animals from crops, meaning that nitrogen and other industrial inputs have to go in, meaning that you have intensive livestock production, you have to grow feed grains. Those particularly have to be use a lot of inputs, fertilizers and chemical and pesticides and herbicides. So all of that was part of the aid package to Europe, and also getting rid of surplus stocks that were accumulating because of this peculiar form of supporting agriculture in the U.S. So the U.S. government was accumulating all these stocks. It did not look good when people were hungry to be dumping them in the ocean. So you start trying to have aids. We had domestic food aid, food stamps, welfare in the U.S., still do, commodity surpluses. Like, where do those come from? There's nothing natural about them, even for the Chicago School. In fact, they would criticize them, but not necessarily look at where they came from. Then in the third world, it became a wonderful complement to the interests as they understood it in what I'll call the development model from Philip McMichael or the U.S. model, to have industry. That's what development meant. And to some extent, it still does, even though we now know that that's a very problematic idea in this moment of prolonged crisis of the next regime. But at that time, it was to build industry. It was to get workers into cities. It was not to worry about your farmers at all, really. And if you did, it was to have them industrialized. So the whole thing became based on the technologies and the mobilization of fossil fuels and of wartime innovations. So the replacement of animals by tractors and then combines, that were internal combustion engines. Then you move that into India and the Green Revolution and tube wells. And those kind of technologies, all fossil dependent, and also the ones that came, like nitrogen for the bombs, the chemicals for chemical warfare that then could be turned to insects. Of course, that was just completely parallel to the nuclear industry. So there was this belief of swords into plowshares that all of these things were being converted to peaceful uses, and not much attention to some of the consequences of doing that. In terms of the interests, it was very much in the interests of the U.S. to be able to export feed grains to Europe. And it was very much in the interests of these new third world countries, as they understood them, to be able to get huge quantities of highly doubly subsidized food. So they're domestically subsidized in the U.S., and then the exports are subsidized through food aid, the famous Public Law 480, that allowed these shipments as concessional sales, they called them, because there was no foreign currency. I mean, it gets pretty complicated in the way it worked. And it's actually quite ingenious. And it's important to remember that these were very elaborate inventions of the political economy, of finance, of monetary systems that are underneath all these things that then became naturalized in our minds. But they're not working anymore.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. And today I'm speaking with Harriet Friedman about the theory of food regimes. She is one of the two originators of the theory of food regimes, and she's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Toronto. So this food regime that came together from just after World War II came apart in the early 1970s when there was a global crisis of capitalism. You've been describing for us the implications of a system where farmers in the United States had an arrangement with the U.S. state where surplus grains were exported to the third world, which helped shape the relationship in a Cold War context mm-hmm. of the United States to the third world. Obviously, also a subsidy in many ways to industries because wages, in effect, didn't have to be higher if food was subsidized. What led to this food regime during a period of enormous capital expansion and accumulation in the post-war era? How did it come apart?
Well, one of the ways I talk about it is that this regime, I call it mercantile industrial, as you said, because it was mercantile in the sense that trade was controlled in food. It was explicitly taken out of trade agreements, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it was industrial because it was industrializing agriculture and integrating agriculture into the other industries. So the pharmaceutical industry now has taken over, you know, the agrochemical industry, or they've merged. And then food production, industrial food production, was growing up. So that farmers were, who had become leaders in the creation of the particular rules of this regime, were shrinking in numbers because the rules were also causing many of them to leave. There was an expansion, and there was a subordination of these family farmers on both sides. They had to buy what they began to call the treadmill. They had to buy industrial inputs for these expanding industries, the chemical industries, the machine industries, and they had to sell, not to final consumers. We've had to reinvent farmers markets, right? They had to sell to these big food corporations that were growing up. And so that industrialization of the system produced a new sector of capital, new sectors, really, that were then constrained by the mercantile rules, right? And so they were very big advocates of opening up this to make it more liberal, the free markets, free the markets up, and so on. That language began. The actual crisis, though, didn't come from them. The actual crisis was first the energy crisis everyone remembers, but at the same time as the oil crisis of the 1970s, there was a food crisis. And what was a food crisis? Like, what do we even mean by a food crisis? Even now, what we mean is that prices have suddenly jumped up a lot. Now prices those prices don't now and never did include cauliflower. They are about the internationally traded and financed commodities. So and in the U.S. centered food regime, the aid centered food regime, they were the ones that were public law 480 commodities mainly. So wheat was like a huge one. And it had been promoted all those decades. And all the many, many countries had become dependent on imports of wheat. And even when they weren't, like India, which was so important for the Green Revolution, was a kind of contradictory complementary movement. I can describe that separately. But they also converted a lot to wheat. And they already had some wheat, but it displaced a lot of their, not only what we now call orphan crops like millet and so on, but also a lot of rice. That wheat became somehow valued as the best thing to eat, a sign of wealth or of well-being, and it more and more had to be purchased, especially compared to other crops. And at a country level, they had become dependent on imports. They'd become dependent on imports that were highly subsidized of grain and imports of cheap oil. And when the prices of both of those more or less tripled in the early 1970s, these countries, as everyone does when a crisis, countries, people, you know, when a crisis first happens and things aren't predictable anymore, you just assume it's temporary. And you try to make do until it'll settle again, if it ever does. And if it never does, you just keep on, keep on keeping on, either trying to defend the old regime or trying to experiment with new ways of doing things, even though you don't know where they're going to go and how they might constellate into something else. So these countries now needed to borrow to get through this short-term, believed to be short-term crisis. The banks, meanwhile, were having their own crisis because the oil, not the food, but the oil crisis, the energy crisis, had produced a recession in the north. So they had fewer places to invest. We didn't have any real estate speculation then. Nobody capital didn't care that much about it. Not farmland, for sure. Farmers were to have that and take the risks there. So what they needed to do was lend to somebody for money. And who do you lend to? You lend to governments, because they can always take it out of their people. They had this thing they called, some of them, an umbrella theory, that, you know, the states would, you know, protect the banks, their loans and their credit rating and so on, even though many governments had gone bankrupt during the 1920s and 30s at every level, you know. And but nonetheless, this was the belief of the bankers. It's amazing what our beliefs can do. and it was a very convenient belief. And so they lent and lent and lent, and not only to the Third World, but to the beginnings of the disintegration of the Soviet bloc. So Poland became a really big debtor country. Brazil was really big. Mexico was really big. A lot of countries were. But they didn't think there was a problem. Now we're going one decade from 73, more or less, to 82, when the Mexican default happened. Mexico said, we can't pay. And that's when the bankers and the governments, because the governments had been lending as well, said, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they hadn't yet invented the language too big to fail, but this was the beginning of it. This was, the financial stability of the entire world depends on not letting too many banks go under, so we better figure out a way to collect these loans. What are we going to do? Now, there were other projects, and this is really important to remember, that the political energy was in a very different direction. The political energy inside the United Nations, the development of the language of North-South, both in the new UN institutions. By now, all of the independent colonies had become a majority in the General Assembly, which is why the US and the General Assembly and the UN system got into such fights, was one of the reasons. On the other side, there was the Euro-communism in Europe. There were the rise of the trade unions everywhere. Wages were going up. Keynesian economics wasn't working, but not only because of these other contradictions, also because of the leakages within the monetary system. They couldn't manage the government monetary and fiscal policies couldn't manage national economies the way it had before. And so when in the early 1980s, when Reagan and Thatcher both removed capital controls, which were a crucial part of the Bretton Woods system, and allowed all this money to start sloshing around, and no one could, no country could then control it, that the weight of those two together was so great. So what you got was a debt crisis and a way of reconfiguring the international institutions, especially the International Monetary Fund, because the plan for the International Monetary Fund coming out of this progressive direction, was let's have a world currency. Let's stop having wars to decide what the new monetary system will be every time there's a hegemonic crisis, for people who thought that way. And let's have a global currency. They invented one, special drawing rights, which is still there as a kind of marginal thing. And they could have given it a better name, but, you know, it's like, not too sexy, but that was the kind of move, to have something like world central banking, and then you would have managed trade. You'd have a whole bunch of things that were coming out as plans during that period. And the Brandt Commission report, North-South, is a very interesting. It was modeled on OPEC, that all the countries of the South that had raw materials could form cartels, really, and, you know, negotiate prices from a more balanced position. All of that, those plans were completely sidelined, and the IMF, through a series of experimentations, was turned into a debt collection agency. And no one except specialists had ever heard of the IMF, but now you've got people on the streets of Brazil, you know, carrying signs about the IMF. Sure. And it was all experimental, as these new things are. So there were what were often called IMF riots. A lot of them were food riots, because these governments, some of them that received American food aid, were able able to use it as patronage, as state building for themselves, as pacification of urban populations. You could watch pita being distributed in the streets of Cairo, you know. And then that starts getting ended. That's what it came to be called, structural adjustment. Things get names after they exist, you know, a certain while. You have to cut all these government payments, even if they're not subsidized from abroad the way they used to be. You have to cut your government services. You have to increase your dollar earnings, meaning you have to convert all your agriculture. The peasants had been very often sacrificed to these subsidized imports, but they were still there, you know, and a lot of them had been given farmer credits. It depended what country. It worked in different ways. But now it's like, convert it all. You've got people, you've got land, you grow green beans for us. But it took a long time. And the supermarkets had grown up in the north at the same time. And, you know, so there were multiple changes. I'm kind of collapsing a couple of decades to draw out some themes here. So structural adjustment, the IMF, debt collection, all came out of the dependencies that had grown up in the old regime. And they were dependencies that worked for the power, for certain interests, for enough of the important interests of that time. They stopped working, and you started getting experimentation with governance, with new rules, with reconfiguration of everything.
Harriet Friedman is my guest. We are talking about the history of food regimes from the late 19th century to the present. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were talking about how the post-war food regime fell apart. Mm-hmm. In parallel to the falling apart of the post-war Keynesian order in many ways, mm-hmm. which was broader than just these food regimes, and how another system, which is often referred to as neoliberalism, mm-hmm. came into being, which really cut the floor out of these arrangements that had been made in the post-war era, these food subsidies and arrangements with farmers and consumers and workers around the world. Mm-hmm. You argue that food regimes seem to last for about 20 to 30 years, and then there's a period of instability of kind of the equivalent amount of time without mm-hmm. a food regime, right. And then new ones emerge. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell us, in the time we have remaining, about the food regime that has come together now, and especially about the role of social movements, a sort of dialectical dimension to this story, which you've been tracing as you've been speaking about how movements from below are often selectively appropriated and folded into the establishment of a new food regime. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could talk about the one that has come together now and the role of social movements of the 70s and beyond in inadvertently shaping those food regimes.
Yeah, let me say first that this is my disagreement still with my co-founder, Philip McMichael, in a way. He talks about the corporate food regime. And I understand why he does that, because these corporations that were born inside the old food regime and then outgrew it and really have reorganized land, labor, food, and grown themselves, especially supermarkets, commodification of seeds, the reconfiguration of all the agricultural inputs as an aspect with, you know, of the pharmaceutical industry, the importance of pharmaceuticals in livestock and in all kinds of ways, and of course in food manufacturing. So that whole sector, I think, was created and then has taken off since then. And that's the logic in calling it a corporate food regime. At the same time, I don't think it's ever stabilized. And that's why I try to keep open the possibility that we're moving out of this sequence of regimes altogether into something that's more ecological, more healthy, and that the role of fossil fuels and the in industrial agriculture and in all of the entire agri-food system that's grown up, that's not sustainable, and that now the convergence of social issues around food because of the impacts on health and environment, on ecology, on ecosystem integrity, that all of those problems are now coming together. And they began to come together early, although social movements like government policies get institutionalized in certain paths, and it's really hard to break out of them. So critiques of industrial agriculture began long ago. You know, the Soil Association in the UK began before World War II. As soon as there was industrial agriculture, there were some people, and some of them were very right-wing, too, who saw that this was a problem. But it may remain pretty minor. Because the big problems coming out of the Depression and World War II were not enough food. And all our measurements, malnutrition is just calories and protein, and still we have trouble breaking out of that. Finally, we talk about nutrition, because nutrition was sacrificed without anyone noticing it. The belief was, and it was true, that if you could just get rid of the bread lines of the Depression, everything would be all right. But that was a time when cities were smaller, when we didn't have suburbs, when we didn't have cars, where apples were in everybody's reach, you know, either in your own yard or very nearby. Farmers were growing and sending them into the cities. But then we paved all those areas over, and the fruits and vegetables became expensive instead of becoming free. And they became standardized and industrialized. In California, you know this very well. But it happened everywhere, either to import them or to import them from somewhere, either from an earlier place or now the third world that has to export green beans for the supermarket supply chains. It grew up in the 1990s and onward. And, of course, supermarkets began with the cars and all of that. So these issues, but the critique of industrial agriculture remained a kind of minor thing, because the environmental movement, when it began, what began with Rachel Carson criticizing pesticides in the U.S., I mean, there are different origins we can give it, but when it actually took off as a large movement, especially in the United States, but also internationally. The first international meeting was in Stockholm in 1972, and it was about acid rain. And everything focused on industry and a much narrower notion of air pollution than we would now have. And it stayed that way pretty well, you know. So, and those were solutions that capital could handle. Like, we can control at the end of the pipe, or sort of, or what goes into streams. Not that they did it particularly well, but it seemed you could at least name it as a manageable problem. Whereas agricultural runoff, for instance, into the Gulf of Mexico, that was harder to notice. It was harder to notice the problems of having built big dams as part of development projects everywhere. It was just kind of harder to see that, and it's harder to campaign. Even when I remember Greenpeace started with genetically modified foods, which of course didn't come on until really the 90s, but the 2000s. And then it was a single issue campaign, and then it lends itself to very simplified arguments about technology and accusations of Luddism and, you know, all these things. So for there to be a convergence of environmentalism, consumer advocacy, which had its own history around food that I think goes back to the food crisis, and there was a meat boycott that began when the price of meat went up in the U.S. in 1973. People don't necessarily remember that, you know, but these movements have their own pathways. And then health. It finally started to be noticed that it wasn't just tobacco that was a big product that was damaging health. It was food itself and how our diets had changed. So on the one hand, the fresh vegetables became harder to access for low-income people. Incomes were getting more unequal. On the other hand, all this industrial food, the substitution of chemicals, the turning the food itself into a branch of big pharma, that all of those were movements that are still trying to come together, clearly. And it's hard, because really what we're talking about is a whole new way of thinking and acting. So did a new food regime constellate? Maybe. But maybe not, because the interstate system, the monetary system, all of those things that have been crucial to former food regimes have never stabilized.
Well, where do you see whatever this is that we have going? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, as you say, there's increased awareness about all the implications in terms of health and the environment to the way that food production and consumption is organized. And of course, there is the looming disruptions, and some of them already arrived, of climate change. How do you think these different elements, the continued mobilizations from below, although often perhaps not as strategic as they should be or as systemic as they could be in terms of a critique, and then the future, which looks, you know, even more crisis-ridden than the present, how do you think that may affect the way that, at least under capitalism, our food production and consumption will be organized in the, you know, in the future?
Well, I think the play now, because states have so allowed themselves to be removed from power, that the main play has been between social movements and corporations and sectors. And it's something I call the dance of creativity and appropriation. So people are continually innovating new ways to put things back together. They're finally entering policy language now as circular economy, that sort of thing. That was the original agriculture, right? There's no waste in good farming. I wouldn't call it agriculture because, you know, the building materials, clothing, everything was coming out of our relations to nature, and that farms weren't separated from forests or wetlands, you know, that all of these ways of growing things in relation to gathering them, to attending to nature, which are getting reinvented as permaculture, as a variety of things now, that all this creativity is coming up from below, different ways that are both old and new, right? Of cooking, of marketing, of recreating markets that are not where capital can't or is not originally parasitic. But then capital just looks at all these things, and they've gotten more and more sophisticated about using, say, UN meetings and side meetings to watch what the critics are saying, and then to turn that into discourses that are very partial or into practices that are still quite partial. I think it's accelerated since the financial crisis of 2008. And the language of sustainability, which used to be resisted, is now everywhere. And so are we even going to define it? The meeting I was just at is using the language, which I'm starting to like a lot. It's been around for a while, regenerative instead of sustainable. And partly that's really smart because we don't want to sustain what we've got now, so we don't even know what that word means. But to regenerate, which can mean drawing on very old practices of different indigenous of any kind of people, but also using scientific knowledge of ecological sciences in particular to build new things. So what we have is this dance of creativity and appropriation. So the corporations, and they have captured not only governments, but international agencies. There's still, you know, a conflict that goes on everywhere now, but a lot of it has been captured by the corporations, which then turn this language and the practices into very particular ways of improving what they do. But they're still doing it, and the direction is still very dangerous, ecologically and socially.
I've been speaking with Harriet Friedman, who is one of the originators of the theory of food regimes, and we've been discussing food regimes in this hour. She's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Toronto. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.